Craig sat in the stern with his feet on the rudder post, watching the dew form little diamonds on the glass in his hand, and no longer really listening to Ash Levy enthusing about the book. Instead, he let his mind out to roam, and thought that it would be best not to have all one's good fortunes at the same time, but to spread them out and savour each more fully. He was inundated with delights. He thought about King's Lynn, and in his nostrils lingered the odour of the loams of the Matabele grassland. He thought about Zambezi waters, and heard again the rush of a great body in the thorn brush. He thought about the 20 chapters, which would follow the first three, and his trigger finger itched with anticipation. Was it possible, he wondered, that he might be the happiest man in the world at that moment? Then abruptly he realized that the full appreciation of happiness can only be achieved by sharing it with another, and he found a small empty space down deep inside him, and a shadow of melancholy, as he remembered strangely flecked eyes and a firm young mouth. He wanted to tell her about it. He wanted her to read those three chapters. And suddenly he longed with all his soul to be back in Africa, where Sally Ann Jay was. Craig found a second-hand Land Rover in Jock Daniels' used car lot that backed onto his auctioneering floor. He closed his ears to Jock's impassioned sales spiel and listened instead to the motor. The timing was out, but there was no knocking or slapping. The front-wheel transmission engaged smoothly, the clutch held against the brakes. When he gave it a run in an area of erosion and deep dongers on the outskirts of town, the silencer box fell off, but the rest held together. At one time, he had been able to take his other old Land Rover down into its separate parts and reassemble it in a weekend. He knew he could save this one. He beat Jock down $1,000 and still grossly overpaid, but he was in a hurry. Into the Land Rover he loaded everything he had saved from the sale of the yacht, a suitcase full of clothing, a dozen of his favourite books, and a leather trunk with brass bindings, his heaviest piece of luggage, that contained the family journals. These journals were his entire inheritance, all that Bawu had left him. The rest of the old man's multi-million dollar estate, including the Rowlands shares, had gone to his eldest son Douglas, Craig's uncle, who had sold out and cut for Australia. Yet those battered old leather-bound, handwritten texts had been the greatest treasure. Reading them had given Craig a sense of history and a pride in his ancestral line, which had armed him with sufficient confidence and understanding of period to sit down and write the book, which had in turn brought him all this, achievement, fame, and fortune. Even Rowlands itself had come back to him through that box of old papers. He wondered how many thousands of times he had driven the road out to King's Lynn, but never like this, never as the patron. He stopped just short of the main gate, so that his feet could touch his own earth for the first time. He stood upon it and looked around him at the golden grassland and the open groves of flat-topped acacia trees, at the lines of blue-grey hills in the distance and the unblemished blue bowl of the sky over it all. Then he knelt like a religious supplicant. It was the only movement in which the legs still hampered him a little. He scooped up the earth in his cupped hands. It was almost as rich and as red as the beef that it would grow. By eye he divided the handful into two parts, and let a tenth part spill back to earth. "That's your 10%, Peter Fungerbearer," he whispered to himself. "But this is mine, and I swear to hold it for all my lifetime, and to protect and cherish it, so help me God." Feeling only a little foolish at his own theatrics, he let the earth fall, dusted his hands on the seat of his pants, and went back to the Land Rover. On the foothills before the homestead, he met a tall, lanky figure coming down the road. The man wore an oily, unwashed blanket over his back and a brief loincloth. Over his shoulder he carried his fighting sticks. His feet were thrust into sandals cut from old car tires, and his earrings were plastic stoppers from acid jars embellished with coloured beads that expanded his earlobes to three times their normal size. He drove before him a small herd of multicoloured goats. "I see you, elder brother," Craig greeted him, and the old man exposed the gap in his yellow teeth as he grinned at the courtesy of the greeting and his recognition of Craig. I see you, Inkosi. He was the same old man that Craig had found squatting in the outbuildings of King's Lynn. When will it rain? Craig asked him, and handed him a packet of cigarettes that he had brought for precisely such a meeting. They fell into the leisurely question-and-answer routine that in Africa must precede any serious discussions. What is your name, old man? A term of respect, rather than an accusation of senility.
I am called Shadrach.
Tell me, Shadrach, are your goats for sale? Craig could at last ask without being thought callow, and immediately a craftiness came into Shadrach's eyes.
They are beautiful goats, he said. To part with them would be like parting with my own children.
Shadrach was the acknowledged spokesman and leader of the little community of squatters who had taken up residence on King's Lynn. Through him, Craig found he could negotiate with all of them, and he was relieved. It would save days and a great deal of emotional wear and tear. He would not, however, deprive Shadrach of an opportunity to show off his bargaining skill, nor insult him by trying to hasten the proceedings. So these were extended over the next 2 days, while Craig re-roofed the old guest cottage with a sheet of heavy canvas, replaced the looted pump with a Lister diesel to raise water from the borehole, and set up his new camp bed in the bare bedroom of the cottage. On the third day, the sale price was agreed, and Craig found himself the owner of almost 2,000 goats. He paid off the sellers in cash, counting each note and coin into their hands to forestall argument, and then loaded his bleating acquisitions into 4 hired trucks and sent them into the Bulawayo abattoirs, flooding the market in the process and dropping the going price by 50% for a net loss on the entire transaction of a little over $10,000. Great start in business, he grinned, and sent for Shadrach. Tell me, old man, what do you know about cattle? Which was rather like asking a Polynesian what he knew about fish, or a Swiss if he had ever seen snow. Shadrach drew himself up in indignation.
When I was this high, he said stiffly,
indicating an area below his right knee,
I squirted milk hot from the cow's teat into my own mouth. At this height, he moved up to the kneecap, I had 200 head in my sole charge. I freed the calves with these hands when they stuck in their mother's wombs. I carried them on these shoulders when the ford was flooded. At this height,
2 inches above the knee,
I killed a lioness, stabbing her with my assegai when she attacked my herd.
Patiently Craig heard out the tale as it rose in small increments to shoulder height, and Shadrach ended.
And you dare to ask me what I know about cattle?
Soon on this grass I will graze cows so sleek and beautiful that to look upon them will dim your eyes with tears. I will have bulls whose coats shine like water in the sun, whose humps rise like great mountains on their backs, and whose dewlaps, heavy with fat, sweep the earth when they walk as the rain winds sweep the dust from the drought-stricken land.
How?
Said Shadrach, an expletive of utter astonishment.
Impressed as much by Craig's lyricism as by his declaration of intention.
I need a man who understands cattle and men, Craig told him. Shadrach found him the men. From the squatter families he chose 20, all of them strong and willing, not too young to be silly and flighty, not too old to be frail.
The others, said Shadrach contemptuously, are the products of the unions of baboons and thieving Mashona cattle rustlers. I have ordered them off our land.
Craig smiled at the possessive plural, but was impressed with the fact that when Shadrach ordered, men obeyed. Shadrach assembled his recruits in front of the rudely refurbished cottage and gave them a traditional gia, the blood-rousing speech and mime with which the old Matabele Indunas primed their warriors on the eve of battle.
You know me, he shouted. You know that my great-great-grandmother was the daughter of the old king Lobengula, the one who drives like the wind. Eh-eh!
They began to enter into the spirit of the occasion.
You know that I am a prince of the royal blood, and in a proper world I would rightfully be an Induna of 1,000, with widow-bird feathers in my hair and ox-tails on my war-shield.
He stabbed at the air with his fighting sticks.
Eh-eh!
Watching their expressions, Craig saw the real respect in which they held the old man, and he was delighted with his choice.
"Now," Shadrach chanted, "because of the wisdom and far-sightedness of the young Nkosi here, I am indeed become an Induna. I am the Induna of Kingilingi, and you are my Amadoda, my chosen warriors." "Eh," they agreed, and stamped their bare feet on the earth with a cannon fire clap.
"Now look upon this white man. You might think him young and unbearded, but know you that he is the grandson of Bau and the great grandson of Takataka."
"How?"
gasped Shadrach's warriors, for those were names to conjure with. Bau they had known in the flesh, Sir Ralph Ballantyne only as a legend. Takataka was the onomatopoeic name the Matabele had given Sir Ralph from the sound of the Maxim machine gun, which the old freebooter had wielded to such effect during the Matabele War and the rebellion. They looked upon Craig with new eyes.
"Yes," Shadrach urged them, "look at him. He is a warrior who carried terrible scars from the bush war. He killed hundreds of the cowardly woman-raping Mashona."
Craig blinked at the poetic license Shadrach had taken unto himself.
"He even killed a few of the brave, lion-hearted Matabele zebra fighters, so you know him now as a man, not a boy."
"Eh!"
They showed no rancor at Craig's purported bag of their brethren.
"Know also that he comes to turn you from goat-keeping women, sitting in the sun scratching your fleas, into proud cattlemen once more. For,"
Shadrach paused for dramatic effect,
"soon on this grass will graze cows so sleek and beautiful that to look upon them..."
Craig noted that Shadrach could repeat his own words perfectly, displaying the remarkable memory of the illiterate. When he ended with a high, stork-like leap in the air and a clatter of his fighting sticks, they applauded him wildly and then looked to Craig expectantly. "One hell of an act to follow," Craig told himself as he stood before them. He spoke quietly, in low musical cinderbelly. "The cattle will be here soon, and there is much work to be done before they arrive. You know about the wage that the government has decreed for farm workers? That I will pay, and food rations for each of you and your families." This was received without any great show of enthusiasm. "And in addition," Craig paused, "for each year of service completed, you will be given a fine young cow and the right to graze her upon the grass of Kingilingi, the right also to put her to my great bulls, so that she might bear you beautiful calves."
"Eh!"
they shouted and stamped with joy, and at last Craig held up both hands. "There might be some amongst you who will be tempted to lift that which belongs to me, or who will find a shady tree under which to spend the day, instead of stringing fencing wire or herding the cattle." He glared at them, so they quailed a little. "Now this wise government forbids a man to kick another with his foot. But be warned, I can kick you without using my own foot." He stooped, and in one deft movement plucked off his leg and stood before them with it in his hand. They gaped in amazement.
"See, this is not my own foot."
Their expressions began to turn sickly, as though they were in the presence of terrible witchcraft. They began to shuffle nervously and look around for escape.
"So," Craig shouted, "without breaking the law, I can kick who I wish."
Making two swift hops, he used the momentum to swing the toe of the boot of his disembodied leg into the backside of the nearest warrior. For a moment longer, the stunned silence persisted, and then they were overwhelmed by their own sense of the ridiculous. They laughed until their cheeks were streaked with tears. They staggered in circles, beating their own heads. They hugged each other, heaving and gasping with laughter. They surrounded the unfortunate whose backside had been the butt of Craig's joke, and abused him further, prodding him and shrieking with laughter. Shadrach, all princely dignity discarded, collapsed in the dust and wriggled helplessly as wave after wave of mirth overcame him. Craig watched them fondly. Already they were his people, his special charges. Certainly there would be rotters amongst them. He would have to weed them out. Certainly even the good ones would at times deliberately test his vigilance and his forbearance, as was the African way. but in time also they would become a close-knit family, and he knew that he would come to love them. The fences were the first priority. They had fallen into a state of total disrepair. There were miles of barbed wire missing, almost certainly stolen. When Craig tried to replace it, he realized why. There was none for sale in Matabele Land. No import permits had been issued that quarter for barbed wire. "Welcome to the special joy of farming in Black Zimbabwe," the manager of the Farmers' Cooperative Society in Bulawayo told him. "Somebody wangled an import permit for $1 million worth of candy and milk chocolate, but there was none for barbed wire." "For God's sake," Craig was desperate. "I've got to have fencing. I can't run stock without it. When will you receive a consignment?" "That rests with some little clerk in the Department of Commerce in Harare," the manager shrugged, and Craig turned sadly back to the Land Rover, when suddenly an idea came to him. "May I use your telephone?" he asked the manager. He dialed the private number that Peter Fungabera had given him, and after he had identified himself, a secretary put him straight through. "Peter, we've got a big problem." "How can I help you?" Craig told him, and Peter murmured to himself as he made notes. "How much do you need?" "At least 1,200 bales." "Is there anything else?" Not at the moment. Oh, yes, sorry to bother you, Peter, but I've been trying to find Sally Ann. She doesn't answer the telephone or reply to telegrams." "Phone me back in 10 minutes, Peter Fungabera ordered. And when Craig did so, he told him. "Sally Ann is out of the country. Apparently she flew up to Kenya in the Cessna. She is at a place called Kichwatembu on the Masai Mara." "Do you know when she'll be back?" "No, but as soon as she re-enters the country again, I will let you know." Craig was impressed at the reach of Peter Fungabera's arm. That he could follow a person's movements even outside Zimbabwe. Obviously Sally Ann was on some list for special attention, and the thought struck him that he himself was probably on that very same list. Of course he knew why Sally Ann was at Kichwatembu. 2 years previously Craig had visited that marvellous safari camp on the Mara Plains, at the invitation of the owners, Jeff and Jory Kent. This was the season when the vast herds of buffalo around the camp would start dropping their calves, and the battles between the protective cows and the lurking packs of predators intent on devouring the newborn calves. Provided one of the great spectacles of the African veldt, Sally Ann would be there with her Nikon. On his way back to King's Lynn, he stopped at the post office and sent her a telegram through Abercrombie and Kent's office in Nairobi. "Bring me back some tips for Zambezi waters, stop. Is the hunt still on? Query. Best, Craig." 3 days later, a convoy of trucks ground up the hills of King's Lynn, and a platoon of 3rd Brigade troopers offloaded 1,200 bales of barbed wire into the roofless tractor sheds. "Is there an invoice to pay?" Craig asked the sergeant in charge of the detail. "Or any papers to sign?" "I do not know," he answered. "I know only I was ordered to bring these things, and I have done so." Craig watched the empty trucks roar away down the hill, and there was an indigestible lump in his stomach. He suspected that there would never be an invoice. He knew also that this was Africa, and he did not like to contemplate the consequences of alienating Peter Fungabera. For 5 days he worked with his Matabele fencing gangs, bared to the waist, with heavy leather gloves protecting his hands. He flung his weight on the wire strainers and sang the work chants with his men. But all that time the lump of conscience was heavy in his belly, and he could not suffer it longer. There was still no telephone on the estate, so he drove into Bulawayo. He reached Peter at the Houses of Parliament. "My dear Craig, you really are making a fuss about nothing. The Quartermaster General has not yet invoiced the wire to me. But if it makes you feel better, then send me a check and I will see that the business is settled immediately. Oh, and Craig, make the check payable cash, will you?" Over the next few weeks, Craig discovered in himself the capacity to live on much less sleep than he had ever believed possible. He was up each morning at 4:30 and chivied his Matabele gangs from their huts. They emerged sleepily, still blanket-wrapped and shivering at the chill, coughing from the wood smoke of the watchfire and grumbling without any real malice. At noon, Craig found the shade of an acacia and slept through the siesta, as they all did. Then, refreshed, he worked through the afternoon until the ringing tone of the gong of railway line suspended from the branch of a jacaranda tree below the homestead sounded the hour, and the cry of Shaila, it has struck, was flung from gang to gang, and they trooped back up the hills. Then Craig washed off the sweat and dust in the concrete reservoir behind the cottage, ate a hasty meal, and by the time darkness fell, he was sitting at the cheap deal table in the cottage, in the hissing white light of the gas lantern, with a sheet of paper in front of him and a ballpoint pen in his hand, transported into the other world of his imagination. Some nights he wrote through until long after midnight, and then at 4:30 was out in the dewy, not yet dawn again, feeling alert and vigorous. The sun darkened his skin and bleached the cowlick of hair over his eyes. The hard physical work toned up his muscles and toughened his stump, so he could walk the fences all day without discomfort. There was so little time to spare that his cooking was perfunctory, and the bottle of whiskey remained in his bag with the seal unbroken, so that he grew lean and hawk-faced. Then, one evening, as he parked the Land Rover under the jacaranda trees and started up towards the cottage, he was forced to stop.